This is episode number 99 with AI learner Twatini Godach. Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. My name is Kirill Eremenko, data science coach and lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build your successful career in data science. Thanks for being here today, and now let's make the complex simple. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to the Super Data Science Podcast. Today I've got a super inspiring guest on the show, Twatini Godach. Twatini is my friend from France, and the way we met was when Adlan and I were on our European road trip. Twatini came to our catch-up there with students, and it was so inspiring to hear him talk. So one thing you need to know about Twatini is that he used to be a software engineer, an Android developer to be exact, and he actually intentionally quit his job and became unemployed just to pursue his passion in learning about AI. How inspiring is that? When I heard that story, I was so thrilled and so excited for him. So you'll hear him say in the podcast that he's actually surviving on his unemployment benefits, but he's extremely happy that he has all the time that he needs to pursue his passion in learning about AI and deep learning. And the confidence that he has about that the opportunities will come out of it, that he'll just learn what he's passionate about and the opportunities will come, is extremely, extremely encouraging and refreshing as well. And so in this podcast, we'll discuss quite a lot of different things. We'll talk about how Twatini structures his day, since he doesn't have to go to work. What does he do and how does he make sure that he does follow his passion in learning, he pursues that. We'll talk about the Pomodoro time management method, which he uses, and actually I was using, even though I didn't know about it back when I was starting my educational courses. We'll talk about what he's learning in artificial intelligence, what the recent developments are, and we'll talk about deep learning and why he's chosen to go into that path. And we'll even cover off some of the major recent technological breakthroughs in terms of GPUs, and Twatini will give us a quick excursus into that world as well. So all in all, a very varied podcast, lots of interesting things that we're going to discuss, and I can't wait for you to check it out. And without further ado, I bring to you Twatini Godach.
Bonjour, madame et monsieur. Aujourd'hui, j'ai invité un très intéressant ami à la podcast, Twatini Godach. Twatini, comment ça va? Bienvenue.
Bonjour, merci Kirill. Ça va très bien, et toi?
Moi aussi. Tu habites à Paris, oui, n'est-ce pas?
C'est ça, oui. En fait, pas Paris même, mais juste à côté, ouais.
C'est bon. Oh man, that was so cool. Like, just for everybody, back into English, we met in Paris, right, Twatini, when Adlana and I were on the road trip.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty cool catch-up.
Yeah, it was really amazing to have dinner with you two guys.
Yeah.
Interesting stories we told each other, yeah.
Yeah, and just that's exactly like, for those of you who don't know French, that's exactly how I felt, because like how you felt just now at the start of the podcast, exactly how I felt, because I know just a little bit of French, and these guys were just talking French the whole night long, right, Twatini?
Yeah. But actually, you told us that you told me that I articulate well, so you can understand what I'm saying, you know. So,
oh yeah,
I
that's right.
That would be okay.
That's right. Like, out of all people there, you were like, I could understand you the best. It's interesting because everybody was talking with about the same speed, but you just articulate your words so well in French that I could understand maybe like 80% of what you were saying. It was really cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. But anyway, welcome to the podcast. So Twatini Godach is a AI learner. So tell us a bit about yourself, Twatini. What do you do for your free time, and what do you do in life right now?
So currently I'm unemployed by choice, rest assured. And I spend all my days actually learning everything I can around data science and especially deep learning. And well, yeah, that's it. And most of the time, when I have to get out of my house, I go to meet up and meet some interesting people, like when I met you and Adeline in Paris, you know. So yeah, basically that's it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. This is really interesting because I just found out this just before the podcast that you actually had a job at a startup, and then you decided to quit it because you wanted to spend 100% of your time on learning. Is that right?
Actually, I left the company almost 1 year ago, and that was a tough choice because, you know, when you are in your comfort zone, mm-hmm. it's really hard to tell yourself that there is a new field which is not related to what you do currently,
yeah.
and that you want to go into that field, you know. So basically, you have at that time I have multiple choice. The first one was well to stay in the company, and I really liked the company and the team I've got there. At the same time, I wanted to get involved into AI. So I went to my employer and I asked him if he wanted to stop the contract I had with him. Mm-hmm. And then as of today, I'm living on my unemployment benefits. Mm-hmm. So I'm more like surviving on my unemployment benefits than living with it.
Yeah.
But still, as of today, I'm doing something I really like. And even if it's hard, you know, because there is a lot of stuff in data science that I didn't know,
yeah,
like everything around mathematics. And so that's really hard for me. But still, I really like what I do today, even if I don't have a good salary or good coworkers. But still, that's the most important for me to be able to do what you really want, you know.
That's so cool. And and so is this something like you're happy doing what you're doing, or are you building up your skills and, you know, the knowledge so that later on you can like either start your own business or get a very, very exciting job? Or is this something that you want to continue doing, just like having fun with deep learning on your own?
Actually, I want to make a living with deep learning. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, if I quit, I left my old job, I don't want to spend like 2 years like learning deep learning and then going back to software engineering,
yeah, yeah.
And Android development, because this is what I was doing in that startup. So yeah, as of today, I'm just learning everything I can, and I don't have any clear goal, you know.
Yep.
But I take opportunities as they come, you know. Like, I don't know, I meet people, I try to get involved in open source project if I can, and yeah, I do what I can of my free time, you know. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, got it. And tell us a bit more about what you did before, because it sounds pretty interesting, software development. Like, what's your background? What did you study, and where did you work after that?
Yeah, so as for my background, I started coding at the age of 13. Mm-hmm. I got my master's degree at the age of 23. Mm-hmm. And at the age of 22, I went into the startup for which I worked for 2 years. And I was a lead developer Android over there. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was like every morning you wake up and you tell yourself, okay, there is this bug to fix or this stuff to add, but you are still solving the same problem, you know.
Yeah.
So in the end, I was a bit tired of this, and this is why this led me to this decision to quit this job and go into deep learning. But during the last years, I was involved in many area of computer science. I was a sysadmin. I worked on security system. I worked as a backend developer, and well, as an Android developer, of course. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, I'm doing data science and deep learning. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Very interesting. And so, tell us a bit about your day. Like, it's from my own experience, I know that it's very hard to kind of organize yourself when you're just like working or studying from home. When you're you don't have to be like, you know, at 9 o'clock you have to be there, at 6 o'clock you come home, and so on. When you don't have this schedule that's imposed upon you, when you have to control your own time, sometimes it can be very hard. So tell us a bit about your day. Like, what happens? What time do you wake up? And then what? How did you go from there?
Yeah, sure. Actually, before leaving my old startup, what I did was to create a clear roadmap of what I have to learn. And my days, actually, what I do of my days is actually using a Pomodoro technique. I don't know if you know this technique.
I've heard about it. Tell us a bit more. My brother told me about it.
Yeah, actually, it's really a dumb technique, I would say. It's basically you take a timer, you put it for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And you work during these 20 minutes, but you have to, like, work, really work, like no Facebook, no eating, nothing, just work, you know?
Yeah.
And when these 20 minutes are over, you can start doing a pause, you know, for 5 minutes, and then you go back to your work for 20 minutes again. And actually, I use this technique every day to get at least 4 hours of real productive work, or not work, but learning, you know, real productive learning at least per day, so that I know that I was, how could I say that, like, useful, you know?
Yeah.
That I didn't lost my time just spending my time on social media or I don't know, you know, mm-hmm. so that I can keep up with my goals, which are defined on my roadmap, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's really cool. So use this Pomodoro technique. Very actually, for those listening out there, very interesting technique. I find it a bit controversial, not necessarily controversial, but like perpendicular to a lot of the other techniques that exist out there. For instance, there are philosophies out there that say that it's very hard when you switch over between tasks. Like, you know, like you're doing something for an hour or two and then you switch over to something else. It takes you at least, 20 to 40 minutes to readjust your brain to work on something else. Whereas in the Pomodoro technique, every 20 minutes, you have to like get up and do something. And you can set this time to whatever you want. It can be 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. You get up, you do, you know, you have a break and then you come back to the technique and so on. And so you constantly, consciously interrupting yourself, and which is contrary to the other methodologies and philosophies where you try to limit the interruptions. So interesting, and it's great to meet a person to Atini for whom it's working. So that's great.
Yeah,
so,
well, yep. Actually, I don't respect 100% the technique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I am working on, like, let's say a piece of code, and I really want to solve it, if the timer goes off, you know, I just start it again, and I just don't take the 5 minute pause.
Yes.
Pause during between the 20 minutes, but it just actually I just use this technique to know that at least I commit 4 hours a day of real productive work.
Yes.
I would say I only use this for that, but I don't respect it 100%, you know, because as you said, it's really hard to like shift your focus to something else for 5 minutes, then come back to the same thing you were doing before.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't work for me neither. So,
Yeah, gotcha. And I can totally relate to that. It's kind of like you get into this state of flow, right? You're coding and you're into it, and the last thing you want is to get up and have a break. And I think maybe that's the way it's designed, that you know, if you're getting up and having a break, that means you're not in a state of flow, where at least you're kind of, you're keeping control of how you're spending time. And if you did, like, it's harder to fall into the pattern of getting on Facebook or doing something irrelevant to your work that way, because you, even if you do that, then it'll only be limited 20 minutes before you snap out of it and you realize, oh, you know, now next 20 minutes I'm going to do well. But if you do get into a state of flow, I'll definitely not get out of it, because like when I feel that I'm in flow and I'm getting things done, like you say, you don't want to get up, you just restart the timer. And actually, I did something similar when I was quitting my job, when I was working in the evenings on the weekends, I was valuing every single minute. So even without knowing the Pomodoro technique, what I did was, I broke my hour into four parts, so 15-minute parts. And I set a timer for 15 minutes, and my goal wasn't to get up and go have a break, but my goal was to reset the timer every 15 minutes. But I had on the side of my desk, I had a paper and a pen, like in my notebook, I had a page dedicated to this, and it would be split into two parts. On the left would be productive, on the right it would just say non-productive. And then whenever the timer would go off, I would reset it, and I would just put like another point or like a line into productive or non-productive. So I would look back and I'd say, okay, was my 15 minutes productive or did I just waste them? And then I would just put a line, you know how they do, you put like four lines and then you cross them over, that's five, and then so on. So I'd put a counter into one of the two sides of the page. And that way, at the end of the day, I could look back. And similar to you, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to count how many 15 minutes I spent wasted and how many 15 minutes I spent productive. And based on that, I would come up with, and I'd be like, oh, actually, you know, I had 4 hours or 8 hours of productive actual work this day. And I'd be satisfied with that. And if there was too much unproductive time, I would have to look back at it and understand what I was doing wrong. And the next day would become better.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I also used, until a certain time, I used don't break the chain technique. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know about that.
No, no.
It's also very dumb. It's like, for example, if I tell myself that I have to commit 4 hours a day of real productive work, I have to keep up with that for the rest of the days, you know. And I can say that on weekends I don't have to respect that. Mm-hmm. But if I have to respect that on from Monday to Friday, I have like a calendar and I have to check each day that I didn't break the chain, you know. I didn't like committed only 3 hours on one particular day or things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's just that actually. And I had this calendar where I checked every days for like 3 months. And then I went into a trip and everything was screwed, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. But, you know, that's good. That's how you get stuff done, right? I'm sure you're learning a lot.
Sure.
So we'll get to that in a second. So, yeah, so you wake up and you start working right away, or what, you go for a walk? What's walk us through your day. What do you usually do first?
Well, actually, as soon as I wake up, I do my work. And if I see that I'm reaching my 4 hours on the day, I can try to, well, do some stuff which are not useful, you know, like, I don't know, browsing internet or I don't know, but nothing special about it. Basically, all my days looks like that. I wake up, I work, I commit on my 4 hours, and then I can, I don't know, play video games or talk to my girlfriend or I don't know, you know, but yeah.
Gotcha. Have a social life. But why only 4 hours? Is there a reason? Was there, why not seven? Why not eight? Why not 10?
Actually, it's not only 4 hours. It's at least 4 hours.
Okay.
So that I know that I was committed to these 4 hours, you know, but I think maybe I spent like 8 or 9 hours because I was on a Kegel competition and I was like, why does my accuracy doesn't go up, you know? So I was on my code and I just couldn't stop, you know? So yeah.
Okay, gotcha. So basically it's better to set it at a reasonable but not a very high level so that it's easy to achieve. And you are always satisfied with your day. And if you do more, you do more.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, really cool. Okay, so yeah, that's how your day is structured. Now, tell us a bit about like what is it that you're learning? So we've had a few guests talk about deep learning on the podcast, but in your, what's your version of deep learning? Like your summary for deep learning in a few sentences, what is it?
Currently, I'm learning everything I can around CNN and computer vision. Mm. I just finished the courses on face.ai, mm-hmm. and I plan to start the new one you released on Kickstarter, you know, as soon as you release it. I still didn't finish the one you released on AI, mm-hmm. because I was doing other MOOC before that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I will probably work, base my work around computer vision and reinforcement learning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is because this is the two fields which passionate me the most, you know.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. And so why do you like computer vision so much?
Well, compared to, for example, NLP,
yeah,
you have this kind of feedback, this visual feedback, you know. So it's much more rewarding than with NLP. I don't know how to...
Yeah, I got you. No. NLP, yeah. By the way, for those listening, is natural language processing. That's right. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's what.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah, no, I totally understand. Like, it's more gratifying to see your results. You can actually see, like, the green boxes and stuff like that, what's going on.
And there is also the fact that this field of computer vision opens so much more opportunities than NLP, you know? When you are doing NLP, in my opinion, at least, I don't see that much of opportunities compared to what you can do with computer vision, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And with computer vision, for example, you can make robots understand the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But with NLP, you try to make them understand our language, mm-hmm. which is not especially a real representation of our world, you know. It's mm-hmm. it's a language which was created by humans, whereas computer vision is a thing which is like native. I don't know how to say that, yeah. You know, but you get me.
Yeah, gotcha. It's just like information that's out there, regardless of
language.
Yeah,
exactly. It was not made by humans, if mm-hmm. you want. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. And you've got a very interesting project that you're working on, or you're planning on working on, StarCraft, right? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I didn't start yet, but I plan to start hacking around with StarCraft and really start diving deep into reinforcement learning, because this is actually one of the fields which is not a lot of startups are involved in reinforcement learning, except OpenAI and DeepMind.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because it still has to make its proof, you know.
Okay.
Because as for today, you can, with CNN and RNN, convolutional neural networks, so computer vision, and RNN with natural language processing, you can already achieve a lot of real work, you know. But with reinforcement learning, excuse me,
mm-hmm.
it's much more complicated, because you cannot. I don't know how to say that, but it's much harder to see the goal of what you can do with reinforcement learning. Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. So just so that everybody's up to speed, let's break it down, because there's people listening to this podcast who maybe this is their first time encountering reinforcement learning or CNN and RNN. So I'll just explain the abbreviation. So CNN is a convolutional neural network. It's a type of deep neural network that is used to recognize images and process them and recognize objects and images and so on. RNN is a recurrent neural network. It's a deep neural network that has memory. So that's what's used for natural language processing, because like words and sentences, you need to know what words came before the current word to make sense of the meaning. And reinforcement learning is a technique which... Maybe you can explain reinforcement learning to Atini. What's your explanation of reinforcement learning?
Yeah, well, actually, for me, reinforcement learning happens when you have, for example, a goal. Let's say you take a game, for example, let's take Mario, because everyone knows Mario. Your goal in Mario is actually to, well, go to the end of the road, you know, and get the flag at the end, and yes, you win. And so in reinforcement learning, you define some specific goals that you want your algorithm, as you say, in reinforcement learning, your agent, to reach, you know. But you don't tell him about, for example, how to play Mario. You just show him, for example, people playing Mario, and it just figures out how to play Mario based on how the human player were playing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, that's it. But I believe there is a lot more things you can do with reinforcement learning, games put apart. But as of today, I don't have yet this vision because I didn't look deeply into reinforcement learning yet, so I can't really tell you.
Exactly. So there's lots of applications. It's reinforcement learning basically allows computers and robots to learn from the feedback that they're getting from the environment, or like Tiotini mentioned, from observing other people, like humans and others, play games. So it's a kind of like a learning. It's a way for computers to learn without us hard coding the algorithms into them, without saying if this do that, else do this. Without the hard coded algorithm, they still can learn. And so the very interesting developments in the world these days are using reinforcement learning for very complex tasks. And games are a cool environment to test this stuff out, because games represent a mini real world with their own rules and so on. So if you can make a robot or an AI work in a game, that means you're one step closer to making it work in the real world. And one of the recent breakthroughs was, I think it was OpenAI that created an artificial intelligence that can play the game of Dota. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I saw that. But actually, some people told on Reddit that it was kind of dumb, because if they created, if they took path in the game that the algorithm wasn't aware of, it was just failing at accomplishing its task. So I don't know. I didn't look further into that, but yeah.
Okay. Well, it's definitely getting closer, and this game is quite a complex game where they have annual competitions, and the pool prize is like $2 million or $8 million, like growing every year. And so this artificial intelligence can really like play comparable to a one-on-one player. The next step is 5-on-5 and so on. So those interested can check it out online. It's called Dota. I think it stands for Defense of the Alliance version 2.0, and artificial intelligence is playing that game. You can have a look at that. But now, so you're venturing to even a more complex territory. You want to create an AI, or take on the challenge of exploring how to create a reinforcement learning algorithm for StarCraft, right? So StarCraft is a different type of game. It's a strategy game, right?
And actually, as I understood, the most complicated part in this game is that when you start the game, you are not aware of the map of the game.
Yeah.
You have actually to do some discovery by sending what they call in the game a probe. So you just send the probe to try to map the map, But this is really challenging, because when an AI is not aware of its whole environment, it makes things more complicated, So, yeah.
Yeah, so that's going to be very interesting to see how you take on the challenge. And yeah, so once you dabble with a game, right? You mentioned you don't have any ideas on how to apply this in real life at the stage. But how are you going to go about that? I think that's an interesting question. How are you going to, let's say you're successful at creating a artificial intelligence to play StarCraft. Then what is your next step for turning these skills that you've developed into a business, or into a into something that you can bring to the world and add value to the world in the real world?
Yeah, sure. To be honest, I don't know. I don't know. All I know is that I want to work on something that I like, and this is the very reason why I left my old startup, And the future will tell me,
Yeah.
I'm this kind of guy who like to do what he wants to do, but I do not worry about the future. Will I start a startup with that, or will I work in that field with big companies? And only worried about doing the stuff I like, you know, and random events of life will happen. Maybe I will have some opportunities to meet people who are also interested in that field and who have ideas to make that into a business.
Yep.
I'm not close to anything, you know, but as for now, I don't know. I don't know. I can't tell you how I could apply it to a business. Uh-huh. But as you told me when you came to Paris, there is actually one real application for reinforcement learning that Google made, which was like to reduce their cost in electricity.
Yep.
And it was reinforcement learning. So I believe that you can make very useful stuff, but as of today, as I'm not aware of what you can really do, what is the potential of reinforcement learning, I cannot tell you that I want to create a business out of that, you know. So
totally understand that, and that's really inspiring, right? So it's so cool to have the courage to just say, no, I don't care what everybody else thinks. I don't care that I don't have a job. I'm just going to do what I love. And I don't even know where it's going. I don't know what opportunities I have in the future. But I know they will come. I know that if I'm doing what I love, then it cannot happen. The world cannot happen in a way that I will not have those opportunities. They will come no matter what. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. And when they come, they come. That is very inspiring.
Yeah, well, actually, this is all I did for my whole life, you know, because I was born in French Polynesia and I lived on a very small island. And I really liked computer science, so I was just committed to it. I didn't have really good grades in school, but I didn't care, you know. Mm-hmm. I was only passionate by what was useful to me and what I wanted to do. And then when I came to France, I started applying this knowledge. So I don't know if it's the randomness of events or if it's chance, but I believe that you cannot have like guarantees in the future, you know, of what you will do. For example, I cannot tell myself that as of today I will work on data science for marketing, let's say for marketing, and so that I'm sure that I will get a job in that field, you know. For me, I just want to work on the things I like, and at some point you will find something according to that, you know.
Yeah and how good is that when you do find something, because you all the time you've been doing just the things that you like, you're guaranteed that you're going to like it, because you've never even thought of doing anything that you don't like.
Yeah, it's really rewarding when you find something, you know.
Yeah.
It's the way I live, actually.
Fantastic.
But actually I think, you know, randomness of events can also come, because I told you I'm surviving on unemployment benefits.
Yeah.
And actually the guy who give me this unemployment benefits can just come to my door and say we will cut the grass under your feet, you know.
Yeah.
So from one day to another, I can find myself not having any income.
Yeah.
But I just tell myself that when that time will come, I will just figure out what to do, you know.
Yeah. So you're not stressing out about it. It's like a problem.
No.
It's not a problem now, right? It might happen.
No.
Might not happen. If it happens, then that's when it'll become a problem, and that's when I'll sort it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, very interesting. I'm actually reading a book now by Eckhart Tolle about, it's called The Power of Now. And there he talks exactly about that. Very interesting how your story depicts the philosophy that he explains. And he says that, you know, there are no problems in the world. Like, think about right now. Like, right now, do you have a problem? Does anybody have a problem? Not 5 minutes from now, not a day from now, not a year from now, but like right now, do you have a problem? No. All you have is like the present moment, and you have the situation that you're in. So what we perceive as problems, like somebody else in your situation might say, oh, well, you know, I might lose my unemployment benefits. This is a problem. But what we perceive as problems is actually a situation that might arise in the future. And when the future comes, when it becomes a present moment, then it, if it arises, it's not a problem. It's a situation you got to deal with, right? It's a situation I'm in. I'm going to deal with it. Okay, done with the situation. Now keep going with my life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's a very healthy mentality, right? It helps you be calm.
Well, I would lie if I tell you that when this day arrives, I won't stress a bit, you know.
But
I think I will figure out what to do. You know, there is no such thing in life, I think, as insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot say that, for example, I'm great in my position at the company where I'm in, and I want to work for the coming 10 years because you don't know what will happen. Maybe you will never get a salary raise. Maybe the company will fail, or maybe you will get hit by a car and die. I don't know, you know. So there is no such thing as trying to forecast your future in terms of insurance, you know?
Yeah, yeah, totally agree.
Like job insurance, for example, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So you gotta be like not even prepared, but accepting of whatever comes, right?
You know, exactly.
Whatever comes, and we'll deal with it when it comes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool. So, and I wanted to ask you, like, so that's very inspiring. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will have something to think about. Tell us, has somebody inspired you? Like, has there been, I don't know, like a mentor, a life-changing event, something that in your life has inspired you to choose the path that you've chosen of software development and then get into deep learning and so on? What's been the most inspirational thing for you?
For software development, there was like two things. The first one is that I wanted to get out of my little island. The second one, yeah, it's still related to that. My father told me, what do you want to do? You want to watch for the cows and do agriculture, or you want to go abroad and like make relevant things, you know?
Yeah.
So I quickly made my choice, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as for the influencer, I don't have any person who influenced me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not one that I remember of. I think it's a whole, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I saw a lot of people in the field of AI, and I was always passionate about creating AI when I was young. But at that time, I was afraid of math, and there wasn't really a lot of things happening in that field.
Yeah,
AI winter, as everyone called it. And when I saw all these news coming from TechCrunch and your MOOC, for example, the resources online to learn about AI, actually, I told myself, yeah, let's go for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you could see the potential.
Yeah, exactly. But yes, there wasn't just one thing which led me to that decision, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is just a hole, I would say, yeah.
Okay. And was it hard to start? Like, there's a lot of, probably a lot of listeners who, you know, are into data science, but not yet into the field of deep learning or artificial intelligence. And they're, you know, they can also hear about it. They can also hear about the potential and see things, how it's changing the world. But it's very scary, right? It's there's a lot of programming.
Yeah.
There's a lot of complicated libraries and things and mathematics even and so on. So was it hard to start when you made that decision?
Actually, yes. Because I had, as I told you, I have a software engineer background. So
yeah,
it's really like my comfort zone when we are dealing with computer science stuff, you know, whether it be sysadmin or programming or anything. But when it comes to math, that's a completely different story. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I still, as of today, when I look at a math formula, I just want to, like, when I look at one on a paper, you know, I just want to to go on a tutorial or find something, an alternative to implement what I want to implement. But this past week, I was trying to implement the UNET paper. The UNET is actually a technique in deep learning to segment images. So basically, let's say you have a car in the middle of the image and you have a background. You just want to get the car and have a transparent background behind it, you know?
Yep.
So UNET is meant for that. So what I'm trying to do is to implement the paper from A to Z, as you used to say,
yeah.
And look at the math formula and try to make sense of them, you know, because I think what is really hard for me on the math is not the logic, but it's actually like a foreign language to me, you know. Like if I see some sigma sign, I know it translates to a for loop in Python or things like that, but there is a lot of signs that I don't know in math. It's just that it's really foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm working towards that goal. And my goal actually is to be able to take a paper, mm-hmm. implement it, and ship it into production. Basically to do the whole workflow, I would say, you know,
mm-hmm.
not just like implement the paper or just ship things into production, but be able to do the whole thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
because if I at some day I will have to create my business or contribute to something, you will have to deal with this whole process, you know, you won't be constrained just to implementing the paper or just shipping thing into production. Yeah,
totally agree. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's a very big step. That's you know, like learning math, and I agree. Like if you want to do the full flow of things, then you'll need to know the mathematics. At the same time, I wanted to, for the benefit of the listeners, I just wanted to say that there's ways to get into this field even without like delving too deep into the mathematical aspects of things, but rather just understanding intuitively how and why things work, and then understanding what goals you want to achieve, and then putting everything together. It's like building Lego bricks together. With the pre-coded libraries and so on, because like in PyTorch, right? There's less in PyTorch, but more in the Google one. Just slipped my mind completely. There's
Keras.
In Keras, with Keras, if you use Keras, there's a lot of stuff pre-coded for you, right?
Yeah,
You can just build this AI with a few lines of code, and even if you don't know that much coding. You just put a few lines together, and there you go. You've got a convolutional neural network going, or something like that.
Yeah.
So, do you think that's a valid way for people to start?
Yeah, sure. Actually, this is how I started. So, yeah, totally. If you want to start and you don't have a lot of background into mathematics or even computer science, it's better to work with high-level libraries, mm-hmm. as we call them, because actually, it abstracts every low-level computation you could do with raw TensorFlow or with PyTorch, for example, because Keras actually is a library on top of TensorFlow.
Yeah.
So it abstracts a lot of stuff you would spend hours to figure out how to do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So do you use Keras or do you use PyTorch?
I started by Keras, currently I'm with PyTorch because the reason is very simple, actually, because with Keras, as it's on top of TensorFlow, TensorFlow use what we call static graph.
Dynamic graph.
So that basically means that you have to define all your pre-processing input. You have to define how you will multiply this or that, and then when you have defined your graph, basically, you start a session and you run the thing. But the drawback with that is that when you are used to work with IDE and debuggers, it's really hard to check on things, you know? It's mm-hmm. really hard to look at, for example, if I multiply this matrix by this color, what is the result of that? And actually, TensorFlow has its own debugger, but I didn't got a chance to take a look at that. But the difference between TensorFlow and Keras and PyTorch is that PyTorch uses dynamic graph, so you can, as you go through your code, you can put breakpoints to your code and just look at the result of your code. Actually, you know, it's not like black boxed as you can find in TensorFlow. Yeah. So that's the main reason why I moved away from Keras, but Keras is very great to start with, you know.
Yeah, definitely, and it just makes things easier for people looking at that space. It's a natural progression, right? You don't want to, you know, you don't want, when you're learning, I don't know how to, when a child is learning how to speak, they don't start by learning by reading Shakespeare. They start with the basics and then they progress. Makes sense. And let's talk about a bit about hardware. Like, I think that's a it's a very topic close to you, because all from our catch up in France, I remember you were talking quite passionately about your computer setup and so on. So tell us a bit about that. Like, so for deep learning, you obviously need a powerful computer. How did you go about that?
I started with buying a GTX 1070 because you have to get a really good GPU, especially if you're working on computer vision problem with deep learning. With NLP, it's less relevant because, you know, when you are inputting images into your model, images are actually big matrices. So you have to have a really good GPU to handle this kind of data. Then I bought myself a GTX 1080 Ti.
Sorry, you lost me there. Just is that a better system?
It's actually better. And what I actually have is that I have two computers, one in my basement and one at home. And I have my MacBook also, and I work on my MacBook, and I actually execute my code remotely on this machine and get the result back onto my MacBook. You know? And actually, on my blog, I will give you the link, but I teach people how to build their own rig, you know, and I really try to explain everything, like how do you do that and what does it mean, you know. Not only what are the steps to build your rig, but also what does this step mean, you know? So that when you have to fix your rig, if it's not working anymore, you know what you are dealing with, you know? Yeah. So, and actually that's I have a 77. I don't know the model of my CPU anymore. But a good CPU but especially a good GPU and 32 gigabyte of RAM. I think it's the minimum for deep learning project. Yeah.
Gotcha. And tell us, what's the difference of CPU and GPU, and why do you need GPUs for deep learning?
Well, actually, deep learning deals a lot with matrices, and GPU are a specialized kind of hardware which is meant to deal with matrices, actually. So this is why you can transfer your data to your GPU memory and then make the GPU work instead of your CPU. And the difference between the two is that CPU is I don't know how to say that, but GPU is really a parallel. It does a lot of parallel work. You know, it has like 3,000 cores, and compared to your CPU, which has 8 cores or something like that, CPU can do a lot of stuff, but not really parallel. And in contrast, the GPU is meant to deal with very specific, narrow tasks, but it can parallelize a lot of stuff, you know. So that's the main difference between the two.
Yeah, and GPU are actually for graphics, right?
Yeah, but graphics, if you think of it, are actually just matrices, you know. So yeah, it's why the GPU can also be used to to train deep learning models. Yeah.
Yeah. So just a convenient coincidence that GPUs originally developed for graphics, which are matrices. We're gonna run some deep learning now on these GPUs. It'll be a trillion times faster.
Yeah.
And what did you hear about the NVIDIA Volta chip?
Yeah.
Well, tell us a bit about that, because Ben Taylor told me about it a couple of times, and I'm not really up to date with that. What is this Volta chip, and why is it so special?
As for today, there is only one GPU which was released with this chip, with this new architecture, which is the Tesla V100.
Mm-hmm.
Volta is actually an architecture for the spelling. Basically, you have different kind of architecture. The first, there is Maxwell, there is Pascal, there is Volta. Currently, with the latest models of GPU you can find on the market, we are with Pascal.
Mm-hmm.
And Volta actually is one step ahead. And it's a GPU which was made especially for deep learning, you know.
Mm.
It's an architecture which was made especially for deep learning, because with Pascal, it was made more for gamers,
mm-hmm.
because it uses a special architecture. I really have a hard time with that word. which actually has some optimization especially made for games, you know. But these are optimization which are not needed for deep learning models.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Volta architecture, or at least the Tesla V100, takes away these, it doesn't really take away, but kind of, these optimization, and it also uses the half precision mode, which is, how could I simply explain that? Basically, you have two modes, which is the FP32 and the FP16.
Mm-hmm.
And FP32 is actually to deal with numbers with really good precision, you know. And FP16 is actually what we call half precision, and which is actually what we need in deep learning, because we don't need to have a lot of decimals deep learning.
Floating points. Yeah, how many floating points you have.
Points. Yeah, exactly. Gotcha. Yeah. Volta was made actually to deal with half precision, you know,
mm-hmm.
in a way better sense than the past architecture.
Mm-hmm.
And if, as of today, if you try to put matrices with half precision on your GPU, you will get really worse results than if you put FP32 precision matrices, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's.
Then so how come there's only one of them in the world then?
One of them? You mean one of?
Oh, there's only one type, right? Yeah, and then you can.
It's fairly new, and as for today, I don't think it's yet released to the public. I think NVIDIA only send some GPU to few people involved in artificial intelligence, but you cannot buy this GPU yet. They will release it next year, I think. I'm not sure about that, but yeah, as of today, it's hard to get your hands on this GPU.
And it says that it's like $150,000 for one of them.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, so not for everyone.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, that's really cool. Thanks a lot, Tuatini. I just have like one question to wrap up the podcast here. You obviously have a huge now experience in this field and all this knowledge that you acquired just in this short period of time. From what you see and from what you know about deep learning, AI, data science, about all these fields, where do you think this is all going, and what should our listeners look into in order to prepare for the future?
Mm-hmm. Well, given the past event, the past news I saw passing by, you know, on the over the internet on TechCrunch, Reddit, mm-hmm. and things like that. It seems like a lot of VC are interested in investing in startups which deal with edge computing. Mm-hmm. So simply put, edge computing is being able, for example, to run your deep learning models not on the cloud, but directly on your device, you know. Mm-hmm. For example, an IoT device or your smartphone. And I feel like it's the next step, you know, that you are able to run directly your deep learning models onto your device locally. Because if you take, for example, drones, when they have to map their environment and avoid obstacles, if they lost their internet connection or if there is a lot of latency onto that connection, they cannot make the decision quickly enough to not go into the obstacle, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I saw a lot of people saying that it's the next step in deep learning to be able to ship model into production. And actually, even François Chollet, which is the author of Keras, mm-hmm. said that the deep learning field is on in terms of research paper is stalled. And the real problem now are to be able to ship these model into production, whether it be on the cloud or on edge computing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel this is a very edge computing is the next big thing for me, you know.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. That's something to look into. You normally think that everything is going offline and more now, but as you say, some applications have to make very quick decisions. And
if you look at the chip maker, for example, Qualcomm, or even if you look at the last iPhone 10, Apple released
iPhone 8.
They also released iPhone 10, I believe.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay.
There is 8S and 10. Yeah.
Okay.
The 10 is the one without any buttons on it.
Ah, okay.
And actually, you can do face recognition directly locally on the phone. So, and when they spoke about their chip, the chip which is in the iPhone, they talk about a neural engine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And same goes for Qualcomm. They are trying to make this kind of co-processor, which are meant to deal with deep learning models, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so. Even by looking at the hardware maker stuff, people, you know, you can see that they are trying to do this edge computing thing, you know.
Yep.
Even the same thing goes for Movidius.
Mm-hmm.
Movidius, it's the company which was bought by Intel. They created the neural compute stick, which you can buy for $70. And then run your deep learning model on that. But be aware that this kind of devices are not meant to train your model, but just to run inference. So yeah. In other terms, predictions, you know?
Yeah. And to your point, so if anybody wants like a really vivid example of this, I'm not sure about the latest iPhones, but on the more like older versions, like for instance, iPhone 5 or maybe 6 as well, 7, if you try to do text to speech, speech to text, like, you know, you're trying to type a message and you click that little microphone button on the left. And I'm pretty sure the same thing on Android phones, like Samsung.
Mm-hmm.
You click that button and it will convert what you're saying into written text, into the text message. So you can dictate the text message. And that's really cool. That's actually deep learning in action. But if you switch off your internet connection, if you put it into flight mode and you try to do the same thing, it won't work because it's actually going through the cloud. It's sending your voice to the cloud, it's recognizing it there, and then sending the text back to your phone. So that this is what we're talking about here when Tini is saying edge computing, is that those models and that hardware and everything will be integrated into your device. That's the challenge in order to perform that there and then, so you could, for instance, do the text speech to text even while you're offline.
Yeah, and that's really interesting for people in this field, because actually instead of paying cloud instances to run your deep learning models, they just let the client pay for their latest iPhone, you know,
yeah.
And then they ship their application which runs into the iPhone. So they just cut cost regarding this, you know.
Yep.
So yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. And cutting costs means competitiveness, and competitive means, you know, success for business.
Exactly.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks a lot to Atini. Could you give us some details on how our listeners can find you, follow you, connect with you if they'd like to learn more about your journey?
Sure. So there is my LinkedIn, my email, and I have also a personal website where I blog from time to time,
mm-hmm.
which is tuatini.me. The next blog post I'm going to do is, as I told you, about UNet.
Yeah.
And actually what I want to show is how I went from reading the paper to do the implementation and explaining each step of the mathematical formula I translated into code, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that may be useful to some people. I know some people found useful the last article I released on how to build your deep learning rig,
mm-hmm.
but the next coming article will be on real deep learning stuff, you know, because as for now, there is only computer science stuff, you know. There is no deep learning stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Gotcha. No, I'm looking at it now. It's very, very detailed. Like the posts have a lot of information. So if anybody listening wants to build their own deep learning machine, I know there's a couple of people like that who are following this podcast, then check it out. It's tuatini.me. Yeah, and of course, we'll share those details on the show notes. And I've got one more question for you, Tuatini. What is the one book that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
So regarding the book, there is one which is not really related nor to AI, nor to artificial, nor to data science, but it's a really good book which opens your mind, I would say, you know,
mm-hmm.
Which is called Homo Deus. And actually, it's made by a really famous historian that you can find on TED,
mm-hmm.
because he gave some talk there. He basically created two books. The first one is Homo Sapiens, which tells us the story of where we came from, and Homo Deus is where we are going, you know. And he's not only talking about artificial intelligence and stuff, but everything about our future, you know. But he doesn't, at the same time, he doesn't put himself as someone who wants to predict the future, but he only opens your mind, I would say, to think about what happened in the past, and now look at our present and imagine our future, you know. It's really, really interesting. I really recommend this book. I really loved it. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I might check it out myself. So I'm looking at it on, just Googled it. It's called Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow by Yuval Noah Harari. So very interesting. And yeah, once again, thank you so much, Tuatini, for coming on the show and sharing all the insights. It's been a fantastic episode. Really loved to learn from you.
Thanks to you.
So there you have it. That was Tuatini Godard, AI learner. Very inspiring episode. We wish Tuatini the best of luck. I'm sure that he's going to definitely find the right application of all of these skills that he's learning. And there's probably tons of companies that would love to have a person like Tuatini on their team, somebody so passionate about what they do. And as you saw from the podcast, there were lots of things that we discussed, and my personal favorite out of all of them was just the whole commitment and dedication to his passion that Tuatini has. How he quit his job, became unemployed just to follow his passion. It takes a lot of guts, takes a lot of courage to do that, and it's very inspiring to see that there are people like that in the world who can jump straight into it and know that they will be successful if they follow their passion. And I wish the same to everybody. I think when you do what you're passionate, when you do what you love, then eventually you will become successful, and it's just a matter of time. So make sure to follow Tuatini on his LinkedIn to see how his career goes. I'm sure there's lots of exciting and inspiring turns that are coming up for him. And on that note, you can get all of the show notes for this episode, the transcript, and a link to Toyotini's LinkedIn at www.superdatascience.com/99. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate your review or a rating on iTunes. All of your reviews definitely help us spread the word about data science, and we're getting close to 100 episodes. We can't wait to share more exciting and fun guests with the rest of the world. And thank you so much for being here. Can't wait to see you here next time. And until then, happy analyzing.